in and out. From the quarter-inch thick sheet of clay, Jilly cut the oblong sidewalls and the square, peaked front and back walls. The texture of the clay was like butter when you're working sugar into it, stiff and grainy, or like boiled tongue. The clay knife looked small in her fat fingers. It moved with a satisfying clean cut along right angles, exact, exacting, but not hard. With the point of a paring knife, she cut out a window low in one side wall, a small window high in the back wall, and the front door. She pinched and pressed a piece of clay to make it into a bit of uneven ground, the base on which she erected the walls one by one, joining the corners after running a water-dipped finger along each edge, and sealing the join the same way. The front wall went on last, fitting the edges of the side walls precisely. On the clay-daubed turntable now stood a roofless house 3 inches long and 2 inches high. Her nieces had left some modeling clay, the oily kind, in a desk drawer. She had pinched out little animals, grotesque heads, from the greasy stuff, and then mashed them back into the lump. She felt ashamed of playing like a child, of making ugly, childish shapes. She hated sewing, and got sick of reading. She kept thinking about some tiny houses she had seen once in Chinatown, made of brown clay, very delicate. Kay Forrest came in to sit with Mother one day, and after shopping at Hambleton's, Jilly went by Bill Weisler's and asked him what kind of clay she could buy to just fool around with. Bill gave her an incredibly heavy little paper sack of dry dust. He gave her 2 clay knives and an old turntable, and told her he'd bake whatever she made in his kiln, which he called kill, so long as she'd hollow out the thick pieces so that they wouldn't explode in the heat in the kiln. She kept trying to get away, and he kept telling her how to mix the clay, and how to make slip, and what to use it for, and that she should cover the clay and the pieces with damp cloths at night, and when she drove off he was yelling that if she wanted to try bringing pots up on his wheel, she could come over any evening, which left her really wishing she was at the office, where she could tell somebody, "He said, come over and bring pots up on my wheel." Mother wouldn't enjoy it. Men were allowed to make innuendo sort of jokes, but women did not understand them. The idea of doing anything with old Bill Weisler was too dismaying to be very funny, actually, but it had been interesting to see the inside of his cabin, shelves and shelves with rows and rows of the bowls and pots and vases he sold in Portland, some raw and some baked and colored. She knew he made a living as a potter, but she had never considered that that meant he lived there making pots, his hands in clay all day long, all night too, maybe. She spun the table slowly, checking the walls for fit and verticality, admiring the view of the inside through the little oblong of the doorway. Bringing the rolled-out slab round again, she measured off the length of the house on it and added a half inch for eaves, estimated the width with a margin for error, marked off the oblong, and cut out the roof. She ruled a line down the center where the ridgepole would go, and then, with an old fork and her thumbnail, scored the surface of the clay with scratches to look like straw. She lifted the roof on a spatula and laid it on the walls. It fit, overhanging only a little too far on the sides. She took it off and trimmed the edges, raking them with a fork to look more like straw, then wet the surfaces where roof would rest on wall, added a little slip to seal the joins, and replaced the roof, pressing it gently down on the house. Now, when she looked in through the doorway, she saw light entering the house only through the windows. The house had an inside, a dim, eerie place she could peer into with her enormous eye, but could not enter, even though she had made it. She began to cut toothpicks of clay for the window and door frames. The work went well, easily, because she knew what she was doing. Her first house, squat and sorry, sat drying up on the bookshelf. With it were 3 improving versions, a small village of some very primitive tribe. But this one was coming out right, almost like the ones in Chinatown. She had been thinking, and the thought came back like the turntable coming round, that it was hard, or anyway she found it hard, to realize that what you did was usually just done once. Once and for all. That doing something wasn't just a kind of practice for something that would keep happening, but was what would happen, was what happened. You didn't get to practice. Of course, there was all the stuff that needed doing over every day, housework, office work, old Bill's pots. But you treated that like it didn't matter, even when it was all you knew how to do well, and kept saving yourself up for the important things, and then when you did them, you didn't know how. Like when the group of secretaries met to plan meetings to talk about women in the city government, and the meeting had been so terrific, people saying things they didn't even know they thought, and ideas coming up, and nobody pushing each other around. And then Jets's exec sec told the women in her office that they couldn't go, and the group never met again. They had just been getting ready for the real meeting, and they had had it. It was done. Why was it so hard to see while it was happening that that was what was happening? Even a marriage. About the time she grew up enough to realize that marriage was what she and David were doing, he had started wanting out. Maybe because he'd realized it too. Who knows? Even just going to Chinatown. Not a tour to China or something like that that you knew would be once in a lifetime, but just a shopping trip in Chinatown. And you saw some little clay houses, but you didn't buy them. You said, "I'll get a couple of those when I come back." And then it's years later, and if you did go back, they wouldn't be there. There might not be the same shops, even. So the thing about what she was doing, even if it was stupid, at least she'd practiced it, and this time she was doing it right. She was fitting the tiny frame around the doorway when her mother came through the room. Julie looked around and said, "Hi." She didn't want to look around or speak, but she had no excuse. She wasn't working. She was playing, making toy houses. Nothing she did could be anything but playing, compared to what her mother was doing. She was walking from her bedroom, past the bathroom, through Jilly's room, to the sunroom at the back of the house. She wore the kimono Jilly had bought her in a second-hand store in Portland, embroidered in jade and apricot and gold, silly, gorgeous silks over the thin and swollen places. She stopped in the doorway to the sunroom and said, "The sun's got around back here now." Jilly bent over the turntable and made a cheerful sound. She heard her mother go on after a minute into the sunroom. There she would play it reading the newspaper, which Jilly had left for her by the armchair under the south windows. There she would play it sitting in the sun. But all the time she was working herself to death. Since the last treatment she had not been outside. She did not cook or clean or crochet or play bridge or any of the things she had practiced for a long time. She had been practicing walking even longer, and still did that. She could walk down the little hall to the bathroom by herself, and all the way to the sunroom. Jilly's father had closed in the south-facing back porch when he bought the house for their retirement home 5 years ago. He had had it roofed, put in windows and louvers and mini-blinds, got it all fixed up so your mother can get the sun without the wind. Then he had gone out into the front garden and taken hold of a hoe-handle and thrown it from him with a shout, flinging his arms wide, and died. Right then, right there, without any practice at all. The garden he had started to put in stayed the way it was. When Ernest brought the girls for Thanksgiving, he would prune the hydrangeas and cut back the laurel hedge. Jilly sometimes spent an hour on a weekend weeding around the roses, enjoying it, and always sure she would do more next weekend. Now that she was staying here, she hardly ever went into the garden, because Mother never did. Mother never had gone down to the beach, even when she was well. She did not like the wind. And there were insects outside. Last spring, when it was only in the lymph nodes, one of the doctors had recommended a book about imagination therapy, and Jilly had got it and read it aloud to her. The book told her to imagine armies of helper cells and hero cells winning the war. "I thought about that army, like it said," she told Jilly in the morning in her soft, flat voice. "There was a whole lot of them, with wings, sort of transparent."
"Like angels?"
"No," her mother said. "They were like those winged ant things, the whitish ones. They were crawling all over inside. Inside me." At first, the radio played just what Kay liked, Willie and Don and Emmy Lou, but then there were four or five songs in a row that were about bodies. "Your warm and tender body," they said. The word body with a kind of thick sound to it, and then love, of course, with that same thick back-of-the-throat sound. "I love your body." So she finally turned it off. If they meant sex when they said love, fine. Nobody knows what love means anyhow. But when the word for what you made love to was the same as for a corpse, it sounded like it didn't matter whether the body was alive or dead. She sponged the counter clean, ran the disposal, wiped out the sink, rinsed the sponges, checked around with a glance, gathered up the sections of the newspaper Jack had left on the breakfast table, put them on the coffee table in the front room, and went into the empty room. The guest room. Its windows faced east and were full of sunlight, which showed all the winter's salty, streaky grime on the glass. "I can wash the windows," Kay thought, but immediately postponed the reprieve, making it into a reward. After. She could wash the windows after. Nothing was really dirty or even very dusty. Nothing was disordered in the bright little room. But it had been 18 months. It was time she could clean it like the rest of the house. It had been 2 months since she had dusted. At least 2 months. At Christmas, before Christmas, 4 months. It was time. Things have their seasons. If Jack's niece really came for Easter, she would have this room, the guest room. It would be her room, Karen's room. That was as it should be. People lived in rooms and left them, and the rooms were still there. They were called Sarah's room, Karen's room, but they were the same place. That had to do with love. That had to do with why it bothered her when they sang about love, as if they knew what it was, as if love meant anything in words at all. Jack knew that. He never said, "I love you," except when he thought he had to, and it embarrassed both of them when he did. She never said it at all. On Valentine's Day, she put a valentine under his dinner plate. Red paper hearts, white paper lace, cartoon cupids, that was "I love you." That was fine, all right. But there was this other thing that was dark, that had nothing to do with talking, with words, that was here, now, in this room. That was this room in her and her in this room, the heaviness of her body, her living body in the absence of the dead. That was what they didn't sing about. The bed should be aired. It had stood made up all winter, getting damp. She turned her back on the bad place, the shelves, and whipped the spread and blankets off the bed. Different blankets. She had given the others away. She pulled out and bundled up the sheets, took the mattress pad off, and pushed the bed out a bit so that the sunlight would fall right across it. She took the sheets to the laundry basket on the back porch and hung the mattress pad on the lines there to air out. When she came back into the room, it looked like a motel room being cleaned, torn apart, unfamiliar. She turned at once to the shelves. She moved Sarah's toys down onto the bureau so that she could dust the shelves. She handled the things firmly. They weren't really toys. There were the two plastic horses, the thoroughbred and the Appaloosa. When they were 7 or 8, Janine would bring her horses over, and the two girls would play, down in the dunes, all afternoon. Sarah had kept the horses because they were pretty. They weren't toys anymore, just pretty things she had liked. They had a right to stay there. It was all right. Things that weren't pretty, that had only been toys or only been useful, not loved, those it wouldn't have been right to keep. Jack had wanted to leave everything, keep everything. He had never forgiven her for giving away the toys, the clothes, the blankets. Even though he knew they couldn't keep them, and never spoke of it, and probably never thought about it, he had never forgiven her. People never forgave you for doing what had to be done that they wouldn't do themselves, like those caste people in India, little dark stick people on the TV, who looked after dirty clothes and garbage and corpses. Nobody would touch them. If you got rid of dirt, you got dirty. It made sense. Jack didn't want anything in the room to be treated like dirt, to be got rid of. But it had to be. Somebody had to. The pretty, oh, the pretty little tiger. She had forgotten it. Made of red and yellow and black silk and tiny mirrors sewed in. From somewhere in India. Was that why she had thought about India? Janine had given it to Sarah the last Christmas. With its silly cat smile and mirrors down its striped sides. She put it down. She put it down. Beside the bookend, the sailing ship. Jack made that before they were married. What fine work he used to do, inlay and pierced carving. Maybe when he retired he would go back to work like that. Maybe she could ask him then to make that piece he had designed years ago, in the other house. He would have the design somewhere. He never threw anything away. A chest with a design of sea creatures on the lid and inlay, and seahorses at the corners holding it up. In the drawing you thought the chest had scalloped corners, and then you saw the seahorses standing on their curled tails. Bearing that in mind, she dusted the books and set them back behind the bookend, and turned at last to the easy parts of the room. The sunlight in the windows was so bright it darkened her eyes, and she felt cold through, as if the room itself were cold, and dark, and very close, too close. The telephone in the kitchen rang, and she ran. "Have to go up to Astoria," Jack said. His husky, grumbling voice was full of his physical presence, his body, thick, firm, solid, defenseless. They sent the wrong insulation, fuck it up every time. He grumbled, but forgave them. He never looked for anything to go smoothly, only to go along smoothly himself, ducking under, as he said, letting the shit fly overhead. Lessons of Nam, he said. Anything you want there?
I don't think so.
So I won't be back for lunch.
Well, get something to eat there, then.
Okay.
Wait, listen, where's the stepladder?
At the shop.
Oh.
I'll bring it home this evening. Used it fixing that molding on the Martin's house. What do you need it for?
Washing windows.
Outside? Leave that to me.
I can do the ones I can reach, anyhow.
Okay, see you.
Take care.
She would eat lunch early then, and go over to sit with Joyce Dant. She called the dance. Jilly's voice, too, was full of her body, warm, fat, and soft, a bit breathless like a girl, and yet retreating, not touching, not quite meeting you.
Oh, hi, Kay, she said warmly, but Kay felt she was intruding.
I'd like to come visit with Joyce this afternoon. If you have errands or anything, it's a pretty day to be out in.
Oh, that's really nice of you, Kay. I don't think there's anything we need.
Well, I'll just come and sit a bit. She could feel Jilly's resistance. You always resisted. You felt like you had to be there. You had to be there. Somebody had to feel that way. I'll be over about 2, Kay said, and hung up. She knew Jilly couldn't argue with her. She knew her own authority, and its source. Jilly was cutting posts for the roof veranda she had decided to build on the front of her house when her mother spoke from the sunroom.
It's lovely and warm in here, she said.
Jilly answered loudly, Yes, I bet it is. But she would not go in there. This was her hour, her 1 hour in the whole day. She went on cutting the shred of clay. All the rest of the time she was there to do what there was to do. But this 1 hour she kept back, kept out, to make stupid little imitation Chinatown mud houses. It wasn't fair of her mother to try to claim this one piece of time, too. Everything else was hers. This was Jilly's time. Play time. Fat mud Jilly making mud pies. Her mother spoke again, indistinctly responding to something she was reading in the paper. Jilly did not ask, What? She pretended she had not heard. She could not stop listening. She never stopped listening except some nights when she fell into a sleep like stone and woke appalled at her sleep, her absence, while her mother lay struggling at her work, which the drugs were supposed to make easy. Was long the same as easy? But now, just now, her mother did not really need her. She was only jealous. The pages of the newspaper rustled, turning. Relieved, Jilly shifted her weight on the uncomfortable chair and went on working on the veranda roof. It was going to have a thicker beam running between the posts to keep it from sagging. Once she got that right, the roof veranda made the house complete. The glimpse of the interior through the doorway was more charming and mysterious than ever, though if you were an inch high and could actually go inside, you'd be in a single room whose floor and walls and roof were nothing but damp, cold, bare clay. It would be horrible. It's the inside seen from the outside, Jilly thought, bringing the turntable round, that always seems so mysterious and wonderful, and that's why... Her mother spoke again. She wasn't talking to the paper. This was a different voice. Alone in the sun-flooded room, not fully awake, since the new higher dosage caused half-states and twilights of consciousness, she was thinking aloud. Her mind was working on some question or problem, working something out. She said a few more words in a murmur, and then clearly, in her small, flat voice, All right. That's it, then. All right. Jilly knew what she had asked and answered. Why had her daughter not come at her invitation, when she said it was warm and lovely here? Because she could no longer invite. She couldn't say, Come in. She could only demand, Come here, or beg, Come to me. And her daughter did not want to come. All right. But it wasn't true. Her daughter wanted to come, but couldn't. She couldn't go into that room. She could only look in from the outside. She set the finished house up on the shelf to dry. She dampened the clayey cloth and laid it over the unshaped lump. Her hands were daubed and coated grayish-white, and she went to wash them. The telephone rang, and as she turned to it, she called to her mother, I'll be there in just a moment. Joyce wanted to watch one of the afternoon soaps. She told Kay what the episode was going to be about, but as soon as it started, she fell asleep. Kay knitted. The afternoon sun was on the windows of the bedroom, but the mini-blinds were closed tight, shutting out the sunlight and the sea. Kay wondered if she were dying. Would she want to be in a room with a sea view? She wondered if Joyce looked out at the sea.
Joyce lay like sticks and lumps in the bed, her face half turned away. Kay knew little of her. She and her husband had moved here 5 years ago, and he had died that first year. She had stayed, quiet, flat-talking. She was from the East somewhere, Ohio maybe. She had a way of being aggrieved, down on things, but she had a funny streak, too, a kind of prim wryness. She wore brown and navy skirts, tan cardigans. Jilly would have given her the beautiful, brilliant house coat that lay across the foot of the bed. Jilly was a good daughter, coming over from Portland every weekend when Joyce was newly widowed, and now staying here full time. She had a job at City Hall that she must have given up or got leave from. It would be hard to ask her about it. Jilly was much more open and easy than her mother, but she held back, too. Kay had told her to go out and have a walk on the beach. It was so beautiful out. But Jilly said she wanted a nap, and was in her room now, the blinds drawn. The three of them shut indoors with the windows covered, and outside the April sunlight pouring down on shore and sea, and the wind as warm as summer. "Where's Jilly?" "Having a nap," Kay said in a murmur, knowing Joyce was less than half awake. "She never comes." "Oh, now, now," Kay soothed, cajoling, dismissing. Joyce slipped further back into sleep. Did she love her daughter? Kay watched her bony, swollen hand lying on the blanket. Can you love people when you're dying? Why did you have me if this was going to happen? But she had only been 14. Jilly thumped around in the hall and the bathroom and came to the doorway of the room, flushed from sleep, a big rose and golden woman, soft and tender. "How's about a cup of tea, you two?" she said aloud. Joyce did not answer. Probably her sleeping and waking were not much affected by anything outside her own body now. Her body, the sticks and lumps under the covering. "A rag, a bone, and a hank of hair," Kay's father used to sing, teasing mother, when she'd bought a new dress or got a perm and a rinse. And so they all were. That, or a little dust in the sea, the soft and tender bodies. Nothing much to sing about. But so you dyed and curled your hair, to look pretty. Jilly came back with the tray. Joyce roused up. They drank tea together. "Well, I'd better go home and wash my windows," Kay said. "I've dodged it long enough." "Sun coming out makes you see how dirty they've got," said Joyce. "Awful, and I can't do the outside of most of them till Jack brings the stepladder back, but I can do the insides and finish cleaning Sarah's room. Jack's niece will be with us Easter week, did I tell you? Karen Jones. She's at the Health Sciences College in town." "Newspapers better than paper towels. For windows. Something in the printing. In the ink." Joyce shifted in the bed and breathed heavily. She looked directly at Kay, one brief gaze full of hate. "Don't come here with your dead daughter." "So I'd better be off. Anything I can do for either of you? You know, if you need anything from Astoria, Jack's up there 2 or 3 times a week." "Oh, no, we're just fine," Jilly said. She went with Kay through the front room, and they stood a moment, Kay outside on the porch, Jilly in the doorway, holding the door open. The light, sweet, moving air touched them. Kay put a hand for a moment on Jilly's arm. She saw the nails of Jilly's hand rimmed as if she had been digging in clay. She only touched her. She did not embrace her, for Jilly did not expect to be embraced, and that made it hard, even for a mother who wanted to hold her daughter. "It's hard, Jilly," Kay said. "Hard work," Jilly said, smiling, already turning to go back inside.